The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered Chumbacasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby, mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa, take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to Chumbacasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
One of my favorite quotes is from civil rights icon Bayard Rustin, who said the proof that one truly believes is in action. There are few who embody Bayard's words as wholly and unapologetically as Abdul Ali Muhammad. An organizer and activist born and raised in West Philadelphia, Abdul Ali has grown into a firebrand. Whether standing up for queer black and brown communities in the face of systemic violence or holding leaders in politics and at not-for-profits to account, Abdul Ali's work is loud, considered, and high impact. Today, we discuss the ongoing impact of the 1985 bombing of the MOVE headquarters in West Philadelphia, the moments they were radicalized, what they learned about how people view those living with HIV after they went on a medication strike as part of their organizing action, and learning to trust when their body tells them what to do in defense of what's right. I'm Josh Rivers, and I'm busy being black with Abdul Ali Muhammad. Abdul Ali, I am so honored. I'm smiling so much. I'm so honored to finally be in conversation with you. Thank you so much for being here and for making time for me and for Busy Being Black listeners. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you so much for who you are and the work you do and for this amazing podcast that I'm a huge fan of. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you. I wanted to start this conversation in the usual way I start conversations, but I really hold you in such high regard. And I wanted to just create space to acknowledge that the work you do, that the brand of activism, and I don't mean brand as in branding.com, but I mean the type of activism that you do often puts you directly in harm's way. It puts you in direct confrontation with the police. And I want to say thank you for doing that. You're really inspiring, I think, to me and obviously to so many others. So I just wanted to start there.
Thank you. I received that. I appreciate that.
How's your heart?
It's been heavy, honestly. It's been heavy. I'm involved with some work recently in Philadelphia. Pertaining to the remains of young Black people being held at a museum, unbeknownst to the family. And so I got word of this last week, and it's been intense. I've been crying a lot, and because I had to kind of work on a story to tell the truth about what's going on, what is going on. And so that's been a lot to hold that and to share it with family of the folks who are in the museum or whose remains are in the museum, and sitting with their grief, sitting with their upset has been, it's been a lot.
And we're having this conversation a week later than we planned to, because we kind of both came together after, you know, the Derek Chauvin trial to say that we needed a bit more space to grieve, to be angry, to be upset. And I'm just thinking how that on top of everything that we see as Black people around the world about what we're experiencing, that what you've just told us is another layer of what's happening behind the scenes as well in ways that we don't yet know of.
Yes, yeah, it's heavy. It's, you know, I don't know how much you know of the MOVE bombing, but it was a big deal in Philadelphia. It happened a day after Mother's Day in 1985. So I was, you know, one and some change at the time. And, you know, I grew up in West Philadelphia where this bombing happened, but it's the only time that a city has authorized the bombing of citizens for no other reason than their politics. And the police commissioner told the fire commissioner to let the fire burn. And in you know, resulting in the death of 11 people, including 5 children, all Black people.
And so these are the remains that are in the museum?
Yeah, remains of 2 of the children who had been killed in the bombing. Because the city, the medical examiner's office needed help in identifying the remains because they had been burned really badly. They hired an anthropologist from Penn, from the University of Pennsylvania, to help in identifying the remains. And somehow, when the remains were supposed to be handed off to family, some of the remains were held and kept and given to this anthropologist and used for university coursework.
I'm kind of speechless.
Yeah.
And what is, sorry, yeah, like, let's just let that sit there, that a decision was just made just to withhold the remains of these children and to just give them over for research.
Yeah, over for research.
Wow.
And, you know, we're coming upon the 36th anniversary of the bombing, which is May 13th. So it's, you know.
Mm-hmm. Do we know their names?
Yes. Tree Africa and Delisha Africa. 14. Tree was 14 and Delisha was 12 when the bombing happened.
Wow.
Yeah.
I'm just kind of speechless. What has that been like for you to, you said that your heart is heavy, but you're having to encounter these families and their grief and explain to them, I mean, what? How do you begin a conversation like that?
I mean, I was shocked when I heard the information. I can give you some context. It probably is helpful. So over 2 years ago, I had started looking into the University of Pennsylvania's possession of the crania of enslaved Black people. I went to a symposium held by the Penn and Slavery Project because Penn had for years denied any connection to slavery, right? We are not connected to the institution of slavery. And so student researchers started uncovering the connections and learned that early provost trustees and donors were enslavers. Additionally, they kind of talked about a race scientist named Samuel Morton. Samuel Morton developed polygenism, which leads to the idea of phrenology, the idea that you can tell someone's intellectual capability by measuring their skull. And so we know that that's, you know, it's false science, right? Mm-hmm. The skull size doesn't really tell you anything about someone's intellect. And so, and you know, the late 1700s and the 1800s, he amassed a collection of skulls to prove his science. And some of them belonged to Black Philadelphians who had been grave robbed. Some of them were given to him by plantation owners from Cuba. He also has the skulls of indigenous people and poor white people. And so, you know, when I heard this information, I was shocked. And I created a change.org petition. And then I started talking about it publicly. And then I wrote an op-ed about it, calling for reparations, because it was around the time, it was like 2019. So it was during the beginning of the campaign where all the Democratic candidates were talking about reparations. And so this has been a few years of my work and other people's work uncovering what Penn has. And so I wrote a follow-up op-ed a few weeks ago, and then someone from Penn called me and basically told me that she knew that they had the remains of victims of the MOVE bombing.
So there was like a whistleblower within the University of Pennsylvania who called you after seeing your op-eds and said you should know about this.
Correct.
Wow. So that's the context. You know, you get this call, you decide to do something about it, and then you have to encounter the families of Tree and Delisha Africa.
Yes.
How do you begin that conversation?
It was hard. I talked to someone close to the families, and this person suggested that I talk to a younger member of MOVE. And so I called Mike Africa Jr. His parents were part of the MOVE 9. He was actually born in prison. Wow. And he knew these young folks. He was family with these young people. And I told him. And, you know, he was shocked and upset. And I told him that I wanted to tell the world about what was going on. And he instructed me that he was going to tell the parents, who are still, some of them are still alive, of Delisha and Tree. And he would let me know when I could tell this story. Now, when they died, their parents were in jail already for something that happened in 1978. So they were buried when their parents were incarcerated. And the remains were handed over either to the state or to other family members. And so those other family members in the state, I'm guessing, thought that they had buried Delisha and Tree. Tree was supposedly buried in December of 85. And Delisha was buried in 86.
On Wednesday, the 28th of April, 2021, Christopher Woods, the director of the Penn Museum, said he had contacted members of MOVE to arrange the return of bone fragments belonging to members who were killed in the 1985 bombing. Woods also called the decision to use the bones in an anthropology course a, quote, serious error in judgment. For those looking for more information about the 1985 bombing and its aftermath, there's a 2013 documentary called Let the Fire Burn from Zeitgeist Films. I want to take you back. I want to talk about a young Abdul Ali.
Sure.
I mean, what were you like as a child? Talk to me about your childhood, if you want to.
Yeah, sure. I was a curious child. I grew up to two Black Muslim parents. I grew up in West Philly, and a Muslim community. So my first language actually was Arabic.
Really?
Yeah, I spoke Arabic as a child, and I was the first child of my mom, who had been born into this community. My mom had converted to Islam in her late teens. And, you know, she came from a very Christian family. Her mother was from Bowman, South Carolina. And she recalls reading the Bible to her grandparents, Mama and Papa, who were functionally illiterate, so unable to read and write. And so my mother knew the Bible like the back of her hand. Like she knew it well. And she said that in a dream, my great grandmother came to her and told her to read the Quran, which is, you know, the holy book of Muslims. And she read the Quran. She then went to different courses to learn Arabic, and she took her Shahada and became Muslim. And so I was the first child of hers that she had after she decided to move into this Muslim community. So it was a strange thing as a kid where on Fridays when Juma happened, which is Sabbath, right? Before I would get visitation by my mom. So I knew who she was. I didn't know why I didn't see her every day because I grew up until the age of probably 5 or 6 with people my age, and I would only see her on Fridays.
Oh.
So it was a very strange childhood. I was in class all day. We had a teacher who was from Saudi Arabia, and she would hit us with a paddle if we didn't get the Arabic correct. And then something happened, and my mother kind of uprooted us, and we left the community. And we moved into this one bedroom apartment, not too far from where we were, like blocks away. And so I then had to start interacting with the world outside of this community. And so there was a lot of, I guess, cognitive dissonance is a way you can describe it. Mm-hmm. It was a lot of shocking, or it was just shocking, you know? People started speaking in English. I didn't understand what they were saying.
Really?
Yeah, because wow. I mean, that's all, we would only speak in Arabic in this community.
Right.
Especially the young people, because the older folks spoke English, sometimes I'm guessing to themselves, but the younger folks, we were socialized to speak Arabic. So I was shocked at like, what is this language people are speaking? I started meeting family and it was an intense period.
How has that intensity shaped who we have now, the Abdul Ali we have now?
It made me curious in ways that I think are helpful and kind of shaped who I am today. It made me ask a lot of questions about the world, about my, you know, about who my family is. And so it made me a very curious child. I had to learn English when I went to public schools. I had a situation where a teacher thought I was cursing and put soap in my mouth. She put like white soap in my mouth because she thought I was cursing, but I was saying something in Arabic. So I had these moments where I was just like, what is going on? Like, what is this world? And who am I in relationship to it? And so, yeah, it just made me a very curious child. I had to learn quickly. I had to learn English quickly. I was held back because I didn't know English well. The first year I was in public school, so I was held back a year. It greatly informed who I am today. I was always the oddball, I guess. and we were still practicing Islam when we left, so I was garbed up, so I had a kufi on, and you know, I had a huge head. I was a skinny kid with this huge head. And people made fun of that. And then they didn't understand where I was from. Yeah, it was just all the thing, all the things happened as a kid. And my mother was struggling. I mean, she was a single mom for a long time. So she was often working and going to community college. And so we were pretty much home by ourselves. And, you know, my father was not in the picture, and I found out years later why. And so that was also something that I didn't understand.
You know, I'm thinking you and I are of the same generation. If I'm doing my calculations correctly, you mm-hmm. will have been coming of age or coming into yourself kind of just before, just after 9/11, as kind yeah. of an openly identified queer Black Muslim. And I'm kind of curious about how that, if you can recall anything from that period or how you yeah. navigated that moment, which Ooh. Obviously has a residual ongoing impact across queer societies and society writ large. But if you could take yourself back to that moment, do you kind of recognize yeah. or acknowledge a sea change or?
Yeah, absolutely. You're so good at questions. You're so good. No, really. This is a good question. It impacted me a lot because people would say, you know, you should change your name often. Still do. Mm-hmm. Like a year later, maybe 2 years later, I was working in this, was it telemarketing place? And I was not making sales. And so they told me I should use a generic name like Greg or something. And so I had to say my name was Greg on the phone or Mike or something, just so that people would not hang up the phone. And you know, and obviously as a Black Muslim, I wasn't visibly what they expected when they saw my name. So I wasn't attacked publicly as much as I'm sure other people who were visibly read as Muslim were. But definitely when it came to jobs, I wouldn't get calls back. Or if I showed up, people would be shocked that I was Black. Oftentimes people were like, oh, I didn't realize you would be Black. That was said to me so many times. Still people say that to me. Or people would ask, you know, how I got my name. Did I like convert in prison or like, cause that's the narrative.
you know. I've been looking into this because it's hard to miss, but looking into it, how Islamophobia really informs and shapes kind of homonormative culture and our understanding of what it is to be queer in the West. And so I just find this particular area fascinating because I think that a moment like 9/11, for those of us particularly who were in the States, I mean, I was in Texas at the time. I remember, you know, seeing it happen when the second plane hit. And because I was part of a military family, we were like ushered out of the school, like within an hour, we were gone, we were home, and they were making a really big deal about it. And so I remember that being kind of like the defining moment that they went to such great lengths to get the military kids home ASAP. Mm. But I don't remember like kind of taking in any Islamophobia. I don't remember this being about Muslims, as it were. And that could just be like selective memory. But I'm just very curious like about how some people kind of embodied and internalized that this was an Islamic thing. So I've been looking into it. And so I'm very interested for those who are at the intersection of Blackness and Islam and queerness, like how that shapes your experience. But you've offered a really interesting insight already in that you're not what people expect a Muslim to be in the first place. And so perhaps your first hurdle is Blackness and maybe not Islam or Islamophobia. Definitely. Your first hurdle is anti-Blackness instead of Islamophobia.
Yes, I would say yes. I would say that because I'm not read as Muslim, that I Yeah, and I often am questioned, like my connection to Islam is always questioned.
Right, as in you can't be, like, for lack of a better word, indigenous Muslim or something.
Right, and right also word. Like people make assumptions about the Nation of Islam, right? So they like, they think that all Black Muslims are like connected to the nation, which is in my case not true. And a lot of Black Philadelphians are not connected to the Nation of Islam. And so there's a lot of assumptions about like who I am, what kind of Islam I practice, and questions around its legitimacy or not. Mm.
There's so many places this conversation could go, and I'm conscious of time because I could probably speak to you forever. I am really curious about, I think I saw a tweet or I read it somewhere that we're not radicalized once. We're radicalized 2 times, 3 times, 4 times. I wonder, could you pinpoint your moment? Because you are this firebrand activist. And I wonder if there was a watershed moment for you when you kind of looked around and said, absolutely fucking not.
Yes. It was 9/11.
Oh.
It was our response. Right. It was our
I also really need to let listeners know that I did not know that.
No, you didn't. It was 9/11. I was in high school.
Right.
I was about to finish high school when we invaded Afghanistan. And I recall that invasion. I recall seeing the footage. And, you know, I'm old enough to remember at least that people were obligated, right, were drafted to go to war during the Gulf War. Mm-hmm. Because my older sister's sibling was deployed. I recall that. And, you know, all my siblings, we have different fathers. So I recall my older sister, her brother from her father's side was deployed. And so I remember that, I have that memory. And I recall feeling really, really heavy about my future. I felt like I didn't have a future because of, well, one, Bush being the president, and then the war in Afghanistan, and then the subsequent war in Iraq. And so I started doing a lot of anti-war work. That was my main focus after high school. I felt like I needed to do something. And so I organized, and that was just a kind of a gut feeling. It was kind of my body leading me to do that. And I say that because that's how I feel about all the work I do. My body leads me. I get hot. I get angry. I really don't process it. I just do it. And eventually I'm able to reflect and really be critical about what I did. But initially it's about my gut. My gut tells me this is wrong. My gut tells me that we shouldn't be in Iraq. We shouldn't be in Afghanistan. And then from there was the organizing work. And so I did some organizing work, which led me to Germany. So I was in Germany for a little bit, for almost 3 years. And I come back to the United States in 2007 because my cousin died of lung cancer, my first cousin, Donna. And I came back for her funeral. And I was actually going to go back to Germany, but I decided to stay. And, you know, my mother got sick, my grandmother got sick. Not too long after that, I tested positive in December of 2008 for HIV. And so then I decide I need to be practical. So I was working at Starbucks. I needed to work. I needed to figure out my life's plan. And so then I, from Starbucks, I decided I should go into nonprofit spaces and work there because I felt like I owed it to myself and owed it to my community to not let someone else test positive, right? That was my kind of framework.
I mean, you're also, you're kind of saying it as if it was like naive in that ambition, but am I reading that wrong?
It was.
Right,
it was.
Okay.
It was a very naive kind of position, especially for someone who I thought, like, at the time was somewhat aware of systems, right? I had, like, organized against the war, but I had this, like, I had this thought of nonprofits as being this sick, absolute safe space. And like, and
sorry for listeners, you know, I just raised my eyebrows.
So, you know, I had gone on to do the good work of testing folks for HIV and other STIs.
And at this time, I think, if I remember correctly, you're working for the Mazzoni Center in Philadelphia, which
which is
focused on HIV testing and prevention for the LGBTQ community.
Correct.
Right.
Yeah. So I worked at Mazzoni. I was a tester. So I was like the, you know, I was the lowest person on the, I guess, the totem pole. You know, I was the front, you know, the front line. I was frontline staff. I did a lot of the hard work. I worked at bathhouses. I tested people at sex parties. I did all of the things. And then I got a promotion. I got a promotion to run a program that was CDC funded. And, you know, I was living my best life, or so I thought. I noticed that the culture of Mazzoni was hella white, and that became a problem eventually.
It became a problem.
It became a problem, yes. At this point, I was kind of trying to understand what problem it presented.
Busy Being Black will return in just a moment.
The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
I'm Josh Rivers, and you're listening to Busy Being Black. Today, I'm in conversation with activist and organizer Abdul Ali Mohammed, who is known for their forthright and unapologetic approach to speaking truth to power. As you'll hear, Abdul Ali played a decisive role in the resignation of the CEO of the Mazzoni Center in Philadelphia after organizing action was taken in response to alleged wrongdoing. I think that phrase is really important, and I just you said it, and it just ding, it became a problem, because I think there are so many of us who can relate to that sentiment and don't necessarily know how to vocalize it, that we move into these spaces with this clear-eyed, even rosy-colored glasses that we can change the world, and then we move into these spaces and we don't necessarily notice. Because that is the praxis of white supremacy. We don't necessarily notice that everybody's white, that other decision makers are white, until it becomes a problem, right?
Until
whiteness reveals itself.
Yeah, and I'll get into how it revealed itself, because it's a juicy and a fucked up story. My mother was dying at this point. She had been diagnosed with non-small cell lung cancer. She was dying. She required a lot of help and support. And so I was working and then kind of helping her through her last days. It was very heavy for me. Mm. I was very close to my mom. We were tight. And so my mom dies August 4th, 2012. And I go back to work. You know, they only give you, I forget how many days, but it was like, you know, 2 days for a parent, you know, 1 day for a grandparent or whatever. So it was only like 2 days off after her memorial service. And I felt really, I was upset that I didn't have the opportunity to take more space. And that my job didn't really care about my emotional needs. And then my father is back in the picture. He was released from jail. He was released on compassionate release. I don't know if you know what that is, mm-hmm. but it, essentially he was dying. And so the prison was like, we're going to let you go and die outside of the prison. He had contacted me and he wanted me to be his power of attorney because he had heard about the care that I provided my mother. Right. And he wanted that same kind of care. And I really was, that's another podcast episode, but he died September 2013. I leave Mazzoni. I go work at a co-op. And then I get a call back to work at Mazzoni and I go back. That's when I noticed the violence. So, you know, you talk about moments that radicalized. So it was 9/11. Then it was when I went back to Mazzoni because they made me, one, my former supervisor called me to take the job back, but then they made me interview. And when I asked for more money, they told me, no, you have to start at the rate you started at back in 2009.
Hey, what?
Yeah. And I took the job because I'm like, this is the devil I know. I know these people well. And immediately I started noticing things. I started noticing the board was all white, that upper management was all white. And that became an issue because in Philadelphia is a mostly Black city.
Yeah, so let me stop you. So what happens between leaving Mazzoni and coming back to Mazzoni that changes what you see and notice?
I think for me, I started wrestling with being uprooted from my neighborhood that I grew up in. I started seeing my people be displaced.
And this is because you're working at the co-op. Is that
co-op,
right? Okay,
co-op.
Fine.
Yeah. And so I noticed gentrification, essentially. And then I start to have questions about the well-meaning white folks in my life who are like coming into the neighborhood and how that's impacting long-term residents who are Black and brown. So I think some of that was a part of my consciousness when I go back to Mazzoni, like, let me filter through and think about this organization and how it relates to Black people more specifically. And so, you know, I start noticing things, I start being vocal at staff meetings. So then I become a problem.
Mm-hmm. No one likes a loud nigger now, you know that. Yeah.
Then I'm the problem, you know, in the meeting, right? I have the hard questions. I'm confrontational. I'm not cooperative now because I'm questioning leadership. I'm making the workplace hostile because I'm naming things.
Yeah, and because you're not being a docile Black.
Right.
And so what keeps you grounded in this, you know, because you'll know firsthand of the particular limitations and restrictions that are placed around Black men, dark-skinned Black men in particular, around how you're allowed to show up in the world. And so what keeps you grounded in and moving towards this and continuing to challenge? What's that?
I think it's my... It's this thing that this gut thing that I always have done, which is if I know something to be true, I name it. Mm-hmm. And it's always been detrimental to my quote unquote success. Right. I've always been that person, but it started to elevate and it started to become more, I became more vocal about it. Before I would kind of hold on to it, swallow it. At this point, I was like, no, fuck this. Like, I have to say something because no one else is saying anything. Yet, I'm having private conversations with staff and they feel the same way. And so I was like, if I'm going to be that person that is targeted, I don't care anymore.
Yeah, if you're going to be the subject of people's ire anyway, you might as well give them a real reason to not like you.
Listen.
Well, I encountered you because I was working for a sexual health charity and we were looking for people who we didn't know, right? We were doing HIV mm-hmm. prevention and outreach in communities of color, including LGBTQ communities of color. And we're so tired of seeing all the same faces around HIV interventions. And so I was doing my research, and I can't even remember, it was 3 years ago now. I can't remember like how I stumbled across you, but it was in the Philly, I think, the Philly Mag.
Yeah, Philly Magazine.
And it was about your medication strike.
Oh, yeah.
And let me tell you, I was at my desk and I was like, what? Oh my God. Like, this person is so incredible. Talk to us about this medication strike, about this decision, and why you felt it was necessary to make this decision.
Yeah, I mean, so I noticed the culture of whiteness. I organized with other people, including Shania Keela and Dominique London. We co-found the Black and Brown Workers Cooperative, and we start to take action. And that leads to a bunch of things happening in Philadelphia. One is the historic hearing on racism in LGBTQ spaces that the Philadelphia Commission on Human Relations conducts, because as a result of our work in coalition with others, on October 25th, 2016.
And so following, just for context mm-hmm. for listeners, this is the first report of this kind, I think, was done actually 1986, right? That was the first Correct. Time that the city kind of did an analysis of racism in the LGBTQ community.
Right, correct. And so we start to push on Mazzoni and other HIV nonprofits to make changes. And workers come to us and help us form demands. And they highlight not only a culture of anti-Blackness, but also that the medical director was involved in alleged sexual assault on staff and patients. And so we craft demands, we release those demands, and then we start organizing. This leads to two staff walkouts, a bunch of direct actions. And, you know, eventually the medical director is suspended, then resigns. But the CEO, Nurit Shine, is protected by the board. And before we launched the campaign on Mazzoni, I said to my comrades, I said, you know, because we always, when we talk about a campaign, we strategize about what the outcome might be, right? And so even before we released the demands, we talked about the possible escalating actions, right? To get our demands met. And one of those escalating actions was my med strike. I mentioned it. I said, you know, this is an HIV organization. I'm an HIV positive person. And if they don't meet our demands, I'm willing to use my body in this way and suspend taking my medication instead of doing a hunger strike. I'm in order to put pressure on the organization to meet our demands. And so this was the last escalating action. We exhausted everything else and they still said, no, we're not going to meet your ultimate demand, which is to get rid of Nurit. And so that's why I started my medicine strike.
Wow. I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, at the fourth day in the morning, I received word that the board asked and she tendered her resignation. And so I resumed my medication on the fourth night of the strike. And it was heavy because I hadn't been out about being POS.
Oh, plot twist.
I'd worked in HIV.
That's plot twist.
Yeah, I had worked in HIV, but I was kind of, you know, one, they tell you not to tell your story, right? That your story is irrelevant to the work that you do. And so I didn't talk about myself. So I was testing folks and people were testing positive. And they had no idea who was in the room with them. And so this was, I was the first time being out to family, a lot of family members, and to the public about my status in such a bold way.
Sorry to interrupt. So for many people, is the first time they hear, the first time you disclose your HIV status is when you're saying that you're going on a med strike?
Correct.
Wow. Yeah.
So shocking. People were upset. I mean, if you scroll through my Facebook and search around that time, med strike, the hashtag, you'll see, or declining heart, you'll see what people were saying. I mean, people were saying all kinds of things. Don't have sex with people when you're doing this. You're trying to be a martyr. They said all kinds of things about me. My sister, my older sister, threatened to like locate me and shove pills down my throat. It was heavy. It was a heavy time, even though it was only, you know, that period, that short period of time.
And so what does this teach you at the time about how people view you as an HIV positive person and perhaps people living with HIV more broadly?
Yeah, I mean, it taught me that people see me as a vector, that I'm an infected person and I should be managed by others, that I can't manage myself, right? Mm. That I have no autonomy anymore, that people who become HIV positive aren't the property of themselves, but they are the property of others.
Yeah, they become wards of the community, as it were, right?
Right, right. And, right. Okay. And they aren't able to make decisions about their body, because if we were able, we wouldn't have contracted HIV. So we're like these people who are irresponsible on one hand and unable to make decisions on the other.
And so even people who are ostensibly, you know, supportive, I'm doing air quotes, supportive, you know, of people living with HIV or what have you, they start to reveal themselves, right?
That, oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
That this stigma and this judgment is really internalized.
It's internalized. It's real. It lives in the people who are in HIV work. It honestly is in them more than I've seen in the public space. There's so much judgment. There's so much moralism connected to the conversation of HIV. It showed me so much about.
Mm-hmm. So I'm just thinking about the conversation about good gays and bad gays. It's not even a conversation. It's the inference that, gay men, let's be specific. I know your pronouns are they, them, but just for the purposes of this example. There are good gay men, the ones who are homonormative and want to be in monogamous relationships and kind of bring their partner, and they wear bow ties and they're very out and they adopt and they want to get married, and who are largely coded as white. And then you've got the bad gays, who are the ones who do drugs and have bareback sex and who are on PrEP or who are HIV positive or who do or all the things who fall outside. And then, of course, you've got you, who is... they, them, HIV positive, queer, black, loud, you know, and like yelling at people. And so this really comes to bear on your body and in you. And I'm thinking of what you said earlier, that your body leads you, and that all of this culminates in you deciding to put yourself and your body on the line again to stand up for what's right.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Respectability politics came up. Like you said, the good and the bad gays, right? I'm read as someone who isn't respectable. I don't wear ties typically. My friends say that I dress like I'm houseless a lot of times. My style is bohemian chic, right? I look scruffy. I have piercings. I'm dark skinned. People read me as aggressive because of that. And so none of this works to my advantage. And then on top of that, I have the nerve to be pos, loud, and Muslim.
Right.
And so all of that came up in this context, and it was wild. Like, I received some inboxes from people that I just would never assume that I would get about, like, what I'm doing and how horrible it is. And, you know, and what I would do is redirect them and say, well, if you want me to take my medicine, tell Narit to resign, right? If you want me to take my meds, call Mazzoni Center and tell the board to have this person resign. But it was definitely an intense time, and it really started to open up for me this conversation about radical transparency, right? The power that I had in telling my story first versus having it weaponized against me, which it has been. My PAWS identity has been used against me, right? But in this moment, it held so much power to say, I'm not going to take my meds until you meet our demands.
Because pushed people to a point that became unacceptable. Right?
Yeah.
Did you know that it was unacceptable though going into it? Because I know that you said that it was the last resort. Like, if we don't get we know that me going on med strike is bad. But did you understand? Could you really understand the response that you were going to get from that?
I know. I knew that it would cause an uproar. Right? I knew that it would be a thing. I didn't know how much of a thing it would be.
Right.
How much of an uproar it would cause.
Yeah, because when I read that, I couldn't believe it. I thought, oh, wow. And of course, in the past 3 years, my education has come along so far, particularly as I continue to read more about the politics around biopolitics around HIV and pharmacology and the many nefarious ways that the pharmaceutical industry continues to take advantage of Black and brown people, largely queer Black and brown people, both in the global north with air quotes and the global south.
Yeah. I want to say this quickly. Yes. I found out after the med strike that someone had done this in South Africa.
Yes. Say the name again.
But I didn't know Zaki Akhmat. I believe that's the name.
Yes.
But I didn't know that when I did it. But then some people told me afterwards, and I was like, oh, yeah, I'm clearly like standing on this person's shoulders, and I didn't know it.
It's a tremendous act of resistance, one that you've, as you've clearly laid out in this conversation, I'm really hesitating here because I find that in our communities, we talk so often about courage or bravery or resilience. And that when we do that, we don't often talk about the situations that require such bravery and resilience. But at the same time, I just think, wow, the courage that took to stand in your values or in your beliefs in that way and be prepared to put yourself on the line for the right thing. It's just, it's breathtaking to me. It's really amazing.
Thank you. I didn't experience it that way, right? I didn't, in the work that I do, I often start from a place I'm moved by my gut. Like, it's a gut feeling, like I need to do this. Someone recently said that, you know, my ancestors talk to me they come to me in the forms of bright ideas and gut feelings. And so I think that's true. I think that I'm told to do something and I realize it by a gut feeling, or I realize it by a bright idea, or as a way to take action. And that is ultimately what I think about. And then in retrospect, I see it as courageous.
Yeah,
but initially I don't see it as courageous. I see it as a thing that needs to be done. I am a very hands-on kind of person, right? So I'm like task-driven because I'm working class. You know, I don't really have a college education. So I think of things in like hands-on, what are the steps needed to be taken to ensure that something happens? And so that's where my mind goes first. And then in retrospect, I'm like, oh, I can see all the bravery and the sublime of it. But initially I don't see that. I see it as a task to be to be done.
I'm being called to ask you about Your Body Leads You Again to close. I want to ask you about what you hope for, which I always ask all my guests to close. But what I wrote was sensation is information. And that comes, and maybe you've addressed it, because you said the ancestors speak to you. And maybe I just want to linger on that for a minute. But do you know Lamar Jarrell Bruce?
Yes.
Yeah. We had a conversation the other day, and we were talking about his new book. And he was talking about sensation as information, right? We get a feeling.
I like that.
And that is a form of information, and we have to respond to that feeling, right? Mm-hmm. And I don't know. So when you said my body leads me, I thought there's something happening in my life at the minute where lots of people are talking about embodied experiences that the body contains within it, the message, the gift, the way forward. And I want to invite you to talk about it, think about it, expand on it more.
That is really, I like that. Sensation is information. I totally believe that's true. My body has seen me through some stuff. I would say some shit, but I don't know if I can say that.
You can swear. But
and my body tells me what I need to do. And I now have come to trust that. There was a time when I didn't trust it. I would say, no, that's not the case. No, I'm not in a dangerous situation. No, this doesn't need to be addressed. And then my body would constantly tell me otherwise. I'll give you an example. I've been wrestling with my father for a long time. There's so much to unpack there. And for a long time, I was ashamed about how I came to be in the world. My mother met my father in 1980 while he was in a federal detention center because she was visiting my uncle, her brother, in New York, in Otisville, New York. And they caught glances of each other in the waiting, in this visitation room. And that's the first time she meets my father.
Wow.
And so that story to me is like horrific, right? They met in prison. At least it was horrific for me when I was younger.
Yeah.
And, you know, he gets out on appeal in 82. And, you know, I'm here now. And so for the longest time, I hid that part of me, because I felt like ashamed of that. And my father's name was Shakur, Salahuddin Shakur. And I started to listen to my gut, which told me I needed to learn more about my father's family and really honor the truth of how they met, how my mom and my dad met, even though it's uncomfortable, because it's my story, it's a part of my story. And my mother, as a child, I would ask her, because my dad was, again, in and out of jail. And I remember being frustrated. And I asked her, I would repeatedly ask her, like, why him? Like, why did you have a child with this person? And her response would be, well, you wouldn't be here. Mm-hmm. And I'd be like, I know, but I would rather not be here if it meant you not connecting with this person.
Wow.
And now I regret saying that to her. You know, she's gone. I can't say that directly to her. But, you know, I've been called to like reckon with his story and like see him as a complete person and see him as a part of my lineage, which for a long time I denied that.
Right.
But something in my gut is telling me there's stories there to unpack and there's a lot of healing work to be done. So, like you said, sensation is information, right?
And I just wrote down shame, you know, shame around this. You know, if we think about the disproportionate incarceration rates of Black men in the US and indeed in other countries as well, there must be so many innumerable instances of fleeting glances turning into children, turning into legacy. There, if that is where they keep us, it makes sense that we might find love there, or that we might find sensation or progeny there, right? Mm-hmm. And so whose shame is that? Like who, that's what I'm thinking of.
That's really powerful. Like you, I haven't thought of it that way. I was always saddened, right? Because I felt like it made my being here less legitimate, right? They met in prison, they glanced at each other. I don't know, you know, it was clear to me that, you know, they had some kind of passion between them. I don't know if they loved each other. So, you know, it kind of, it brings up all these these ideas of like being a bastard or like being wanted or being planned, right? Mm-hmm. And like you said, like that is, love is found also in the carceral state.
Right? Against all odds, right?
Against all odds.
You know,
it helped me to hold all the complexity of people I come from and to know that the story isn't cute all the time, no. But it's my story, you know? And you ask about what I hope for. I hope that I live to see a world where Black people have more degrees of freedom, that we can move our bodies and be free in more ways than I currently experience in my body.
Abdul Ali Muhammad is a Black magical queer activist and organizer who was made and raised in West Philadelphia. They are one of the co-founders of the Black and Brown Workers Collective, and you'll find more links to their work in the show notes. Busy Being Black is the podcast exploring how we live in the fullness of our queer Black lives. Thank you to our partners, UK Black Pride, Blackout UK, The 10th, Schools Out, and to you, the listeners. Your support of Busy Being Black means the world. Please do rate and review the show and tell others. The more you do, the more people like us get to hear the stories and voices amplified here. And finally, thank you to my friend and co-conspirator, Lazarus Lynch, a musician and culinary extraordinaire based in New York City, for creating Busy Being Black's triumphant and ancestral theme music. I'm so busy being black.
Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, no, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.